I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Egyptians held a demonstration in Cairo yesterday calling for more democracy and less autocratic rule by President Hosni Mubarak. But this demonstration was different from the others in the month since Mubarak hinted at democratic reform. Joining us on the line from Cairo with more is Dan Murphy, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Dan, to yesterday's demonstration first, there have been rallies held by opposition leaders recently, but yesterday's involved the group the Muslim Brotherhood. Who are they, and what happened that was different?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood are the most cohesive and strongest, with the deepest roots, opposition force in the country. They're also officially illegal, but they are sort of semi-tolerated by the government. They have a number of members of parliament, and it's acknowledged they belong to the Brotherhood. And yesterday, they called their first sort of wildcat strike for a long time. They've had protests of the official nature in the recent past, but this is the first time they've done something without government permission. And while other opposition groups have had protests that were largely left unmolested recently, those groups don't have the grassroots support of the Brotherhood. So it seems that the government grew alarmed at this and cracked down pretty hard.
What happened?
Well, there were about 90 to 100 arrests in at least four different Egyptian cities yesterday. The original plan was for the Brotherhood to have a big demonstration outside Parliament calling for democratic change. They got within a half a mile of Parliament, and they ended up having a second demonstration with a few thousand people in a central square in the middle of the city, but were vastly outnumbered by thousands, if not tens of thousands, of security forces on the streets. They shut down the metro stops in the area around where the protests were going to be held. And again, a lot of their people got rolled up.
Well, there have been other demonstrations in recent months by the so-called Kifaya or Enough movement, a different group of people. Can you remind us of who they are?
The Kifaya movement shares one thing in common, or at least two things in common with the Brotherhood. A, they want to get rid of Mubarak. And B, they are very upset with Egypt's close relationship with the United States. But the Kafaya movement people tend to be secularists. They tend to be sort of traditional leftists. And at the moment, they're a really urban phenomenon amongst a sort of elite strata of society.
Are the Kafaya people alarmed that the Brotherhood is jumping into the fray?
They're both happy and they're alarmed. When you talk to them, they say, look, the more people getting out in the streets calling for change, the better for all of us. If we have large numbers of people and a high frequency of protest, it gets harder and harder for the regime to really bust heads and to crack down on them. However, they have dramatically different visions for the future of the country, and a lot of them will acknowledge that they fear that the Brotherhood might come to power and impose a variety of Islamic laws.
Yeah. Hosni Mubarak, to remind us, took office after Anwar Sadat was assassinated. He's ruled Egypt for almost 25 years. As we said, he hinted at perhaps having opposition candidates in the next election, as opposed to having it be, as you write, just a referendum on his rule. Is there any sense, though, that Egypt might be headed for a Ukrainian outcome or a Lebanese outcome? In other words, more unrest prior to those elections?
I think Egypt's a long way from that at the moment. I don't think it's going to get out of control or become violent or have huge numbers of people on the streets anytime soon.
Well, last week, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice told reporters that elections in Egypt won't look like U.S. elections. What do you think will happen? Do you think President Mubarak is ready to allow a group like the Muslim Brotherhood to enter the political mainstream, or do you think he will crack down more?
I think that the strategy for the government is quite clear. They're going to do as much as they can to make it look as if they're reforming, and they are going to try to set up the rules so that it is impossible for the Brotherhood to take many more seats in Parliament than they already have. Probably the multiple candidates for the presidency will still have to be nominated by Parliament, and there's probably going to be a vetting process which is going to disqualify a lot of the people that would be the strongest real candidates. And so you may have a straw man standing up against Mubarak or against, perhaps if he decides not to run, one of the people close to him.
Dan Murphy, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Cairo. And Dan, what's been the reaction today to the arrests of members of the Muslim Brotherhood over the weekend?
The Brotherhood is obviously upset about it, and they're saying it's because the government fears their popularity and the power they represent in numbers. There hasn't been a whole lot in the official press. press is fairly tightly controlled here. I think we'll probably see some more opinion pieces coming out in the next couple of days.
Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
And now we're going to take a moment to learn about a new movement in wildlife management to connect reserves along natural wildlife corridors. The Y2Y, for instance, would connect the Yellowstone in Wyoming to Canada's Yukon, 2,100 miles along the remote Rocky Mountains. Why? Y2Y? Well, in 1998, a wildlife biologist set out to find out, to hike, paddle, and ski those 2,100 miles and test this new idea of loosely connecting national parks. He started with one girlfriend, ended up with another, had one constant companion, a remarkable border collie named Webster, and the ever-present avalanches, raging rivers, and grizzlies. Carson Hoyer tells the tale of his long walk in his book, Walking the Big Wild, from Yellowstone to the Yukon on the Grizzly Bears Trail. It's a terrific read, a bestseller in Canada, and now out in paperback in the U.S., and we welcome Carson.
Thank you.
Why walk the trail of the grizzly bear?
Well, the whole trip came about, I mean, certainly there was an appeal to the adventure, but the big reason that I decided to do the trip was to test this idea of the Yellowstone to Yukon vision. And that vision tries to get people to look at wildlife conservation in a whole new, different way.
Yeah, let's explain that, because as it is now, wildlife are sort of encircled in these huge natural parks, land masses in the U.S. and Canada, and they're sort of contained in those parks.
Exactly, and a lot of those parks are becoming islands, which is the big problem. They're becoming islands of wildness surrounded by development. It's getting increasingly difficult for wildlife to get on and off those islands, especially wide-ranging animals like grizzly bears, wolves, cougars, wolverines. And what science has found is that they need to be able to move much more than they can on any one of these islands. They need to be able to move, for instance, across an area about 10 times the size of Yellowstone in order to be able to survive things like disease, fire, and to avoid inbreeding.
Well, now, you were doubtful of this at first, and then you made a trip to South Africa. What did you find there that convinced you of the Y2Y?
Well, in South Africa, I really experienced a glimpse of the future. You know, I was working in a wildlife area there where the cheetahs, the wild dogs, all the big predators couldn't get on to this place.
They actually have it barbed wired.
Yeah, it's surrounded by an 8-foot-high electrified fence, and if any animal wants to leave or come in, or any animals need new mates, they have to be mediated by human assistance. So we were trapping, capturing, and releasing animals. It was highly intrusive.
Well, now, why is that? Because people would say, but wait a minute, that protects them. That's what we're doing. We're protecting these endangered animals. Why is that not so?
Well, really, it's not so because animals, they can't. It'd be like you and I living in a house, and there we'd be confined to the bedroom, mm-hmm. and we'd go down the hallway, and all of a sudden the kitchen is walled off, and we can't eat. Or we want to go to the bathroom, and we can't go there. And that's what's happening to wildlife. They're meeting some of their needs, but not all of them. For instance, bears in some places are being cut off from their prime denning areas. Wolves are being cut off from some of the areas that have the highest levels of their prey. Mm-hmm. And so really we have to have an interconnected system of reserves rather than the old way that we've been doing things, which is looking at individual areas, right, drawing a boundary around them, and assuming that on these islands wildlife are going to be fine.
So you go on the trail of the grizzly to prove what?
I set off to travel like a grizzly bear would or a wolf would, you know, step by step, to experience whether or not there were barriers in between these different reserves and parks, and if they existed, what level of restoration would be required. So, and I should back up a little bit. What I was doing, I needed some sort of a litmus test or a measure of wildness as I went along the way. And so what I used was the presence or absence of recent grizzly bear sign. And in many cases, as I've outlined in the book, the bears themselves.
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, let's discuss one of those. It's late in your travels, but just to give people a sense of, you know, what you were dealing with, you came across not just the bear tracks or the scat or the, what else did you look for?
Digs, rub trees.
Yeah, they would dig up roots to eat. And,
exactly.
And rub their fur, rub
yeah,
their hair
up
against
on trees, and it's often sort of a communication post for other bears passing in the area.
Wow. But as you said, occasionally you'd come across them.
Yeah.
There's one part in particular. Tell us where this is.
Well, this reading I'm going to do is set in northern British Columbia, and it's a It's probably the wildest part of the whole trip. It was 50 days from one road to the next. There was 36 consecutive days where myself and my hiking partner at the time, Leanne Allison, where we did not see another person, so over a month. And this is a morning where Leanne's finishing taking down camp, and I've set off alone to scout out a potential route up a canyon, and this is what happened. All of a sudden, as I'm going up this canyon, there's a bear following me. "Hey, go on, get!" I picked up a rock and tossed it, but the bear kept coming. I grabbed two more and banged them together, but still it came, unfazed by the sharp cracks that echoed down the canyon. Webster crowded against my feet as I continued throwing, all of the rocks bouncing uselessly while the bear continued to press forward. 50 meters. 40. 30. "Stay back!" I yelled. No reaction. When it stepped into the creek, I went crazy. The water was a boundary in my mind, and if the bear crossed it, I knew it would all be over. Other than the bear spray, which was useless beyond 5 meters, rage was the only weapon I had left. I went berserk, unleashing a torrent of screams, sticks, and stones, roaring while I tossed everything within reach. Finally, the bear hesitated for a moment, standing on its hind legs, 4 feet dangling in the water. There was a crack of uncertainty in its gaze, and I fought like something possessed to wedge it apart further. I threw more rocks, bigger rocks, harder and harder. Then, one of the fist-sized stones connected with a thud. It was enough to turn the bear's hesitation into a retreat. In one motion, it backed out of the water and streaked down the creek bank, disappearing into a triangle of trees. I shed a few tears of relief as Webster stood there beside me, watching where the bear had vanished.
Carsten Hoyer reading from his book Walking the Big Wild. On the trail of the grizzly bear, and in that section, well, on the trail with the grizzly bear. How big was that bear?
Oh, it's pretty hard to say, but somewhere in the order of 400 pounds.
You know, there were times reading of your hike, I could smell fear. I could smell other things, too. I mean, you could, again, you know, something about, why would you do this? Why would you be in this danger?
Well, you know, I think fear is an important thing to try to come to terms with, and that's one of the great things about having these wild areas where you still do have critters that can hurt us, that could potentially even kill us.
And why is that important?
Well, I think in the world, like, I've just come from a couple of days in Manhattan, and it's pretty easy to marvel sort of at the how smart and intelligent we are as a species and all our great technology. But I think it's pretty important every once in a while as a human to go out and feel small in the food chain. And I think, you know, as we lose more and more of these areas and as we lose more and more bears, those kinds of experiences become less and less likely. And I think that comes at a tremendous cost. We become very audacious and almost insolent as a species on the planet.
Carsten Hoyer's book, Walking the Big Wild, tells of his 2,100-mile hike from Yellowstone to the Yukon tracking grizzly bears. When we come back, what some ranchers and developers along Carsten's route think about this still very controversial theory of connecting parks along natural corridors. They happen to live on those corridors now. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation with Carsten Hoyer, whose book Walking the Big Wild from Yellowstone to the Yukon is now out in paperback in the U.S. Carsten's the wildlife biologist who hiked the 2,100 miles from Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming through some of the most remote areas of Western Canada up to the Yukon, a trip called the Y2Y, to test an environmental theory which argues that the national park systems and human development are endangering wild animals by restricting their movement. And Carsten, you were following, tracking the grizzly. What did you find out?
Well, if you added up all the days that we tracked from Yellowstone right up to the Yukon, it was 188 days. So just over 6 months straight, if you added them all up. And there was hiking, there was canoeing, there was skiing. And of those 188 days, 160, we saw this fresh grizzly bear sign. So we saw evidence of wildness, essentially.
And of the bear's need to travel back and forth.
Exactly. And so of these 160 out of 188 days where we saw that, it really told me that, you know, unlike places like Florida where they're trying to reinstitute lands for the Florida panther, unlike places out in Europe where they're trying to bring the wolf back, you know, we're talking about a place where all those things haven't been lost, where we don't have to go into a huge age of restoration. 160 out of 188 days is 85% of the time that we walked from Yellowstone to the Yukon, these corridors and these connections that we're hoping to establish between the different parks and reserves do exist.
And are being used by the bears and wolverines. You saw wolverine paths as well.
Exactly.
But then critics might say, well, if they are making the travel, then what's the problem?
Well, the problem is there were some areas where they weren't and areas where they're disappearing very quickly. And one of those areas is actually right along the Canada-U.S. border, just north of the U.S. and Canada, a place called the Crow's Nest Pass. You have coal mines. You have a very, very active forestry industry. You have increasing levels of tourism. You have a whole burgeoning skiing industry where you have more and more people coming down, subdividing ranch lands that were once open and easy for wildlife to get through with more and more ranchettes and weekend homes.
Well, let's talk more about that. What is the actual suggestion of Y2Y, to take people off ranches, to shut down logging facilities?
Well, I'll start by saying what it isn't. And what it isn't a huge park proposal that stretches from Yellowstone to the Yukon. You know, we're not talking about wildlife in and people out. It isn't as black and white as that. What it is a vision for where people and wildlife can continue to coexist into the future. And so if you have targets. You have targets of the size of the ranches, for instance, that they stay big and relatively open so wildlife can still flow through. You have targets on the maximum density of roads. And that really isn't talking about doing much more than exists now, but the trends are showing that, you know, that we're ramping up the level of activity in all these critical connections. And we're about to lose some of the most important ones here unless we make a plan very soon.
It's about trying to maintain almost what's already there. But will people lose their jobs? Will people lose their homes?
Certainly not lose their homes. Jobs may change, I think, in some areas. For instance, maybe instead of massive clear cutting in areas, you have selective cutting. So you have a number of smaller operators operating one area rather than one big operator who just has one certain way of doing things.
In fact, it's very interesting how many loggers, snowmobilers, hunters you came across who were all for this because, in fact, this saves the area that they enjoy.
Well, I think, you know, what I really found, Robin, during the trip is that I had all sorts of preconceptions about stereotypes of people before I left and what snowmobilers like, what loggers were like. And by the end, you know, I think you're pretty hard-pressed to find anybody in any of these areas, coal miners, anybody that you'd walk up to and you'd ask them what their vision of the future of that area was, and wildlife would often come in at the top of the list. I mean, it always would come in at the top of the list.
Mm. So many things could have happened to you. I'm looking at a section where you and some friends ski over what you thought was a snow-covered rock. You get on the other side and you see it's just a piece of snow sticking out, held up by nothing but air.
Right.
And at that moment, you realize, again, as you do many times, what have I done?
Yeah, no, quite often.
Well, in one case, watching as you've just forded a ridiculous river that washes you downstream a couple hundred yards, it's so powerful, and then you turn around and watch what you're realizing is the love of your life, your future wife. She follows you and almost drowns. And I got to tell you, that's a place in the book where I got kind of angry, because it's one thing for two adults to make a decision to go on this trip. But then Webster, your loyal dog, jumps in the river after you, and he almost drowns. And I'm wondering, did you ever think, what have I done to have these people follow me on this?
Yeah, both the dog Webster and my future wife Leanne, you know, are these souls who love adventure themselves, and so we were all thriving on the exhilaration of, you know, swimming these wild rivers and just being surrounded by wildness for months at a time. And and there's no introducing doubts. You just go about trying to make it happen.
Right. How is this phenomenal border collie Webster, who saved your life at another point? He's the one who barked at one point and alerted you to a bear.
Right. No, Webster had a wonderful life, but it ended just before Christmas this year. And he was 13 years old, a border collie, and he just started going senile. Mm. And so actually I put him down myself, which was extremely difficult.
We all know about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I put him on the riverbank where we live, and it was quite interesting to watch over the course of the next week. Ravens, eagles, coyotes, and even a couple wolves came in, and within a week, there was absolutely nothing of him left. So he's out in the Y2Y system right now.
Does that give you comfort? That would be so hard for most people.
Oh, tremendous comfort.
But you'll look up and see a
And you see a raven, and, you know, maybe that's Webster's eye flying over you, looking down. It's nature. I mean, that's the recycling of all the parts.
And he gave you the trip of a lifetime, the hike of a lifetime.
Yeah, Webster was always game for a walk. And when he got up off the couch or out of the car, and he never had to change or put on different footwear, and he never knew whether it was to the corner store or out for another 18 months from Yellowstone to the Yukon.
Wildlife biologist Carsten Hoyer, his book, Walking the Big Wild from Yellowstone to the Yukon on the Grizzly's Bear Trail, is a terrific read, and it's now out in paperback in the U.S. And tomorrow on Here and Now, the case of Terry Schiavo highlights the need to get in writing what you want to happen should the unthinkable happen. We'll look at the wide variety of laws out there regarding living wills. That's tomorrow. Stay with us as more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On Thursday, the people of Zimbabwe will go to the polls to elect a new parliament in an election that's being closely watched. Presidential elections in 2002 were marred by violence and allegations of widespread voting fraud. Recently, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said that Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe was running a government that is an outpost of tyranny. Mugabe's been particularly harsh on independent journalists, arresting many of them and sending others into exile. Some of those journalists have found, though, that borders matter little. Consider the case of a radio station run in London by Zimbabweans. Here now is Michael Goldfarb reports.
Every day for the last 3 years, a group of Zimbabwean exiled journalists working from a small studio in suburban London have taken to the airwaves.
This is SW Radio Africa, Zimbabwe's independent voice, broadcasting on shortwave between 6 and 9 every evening and on medium wave between 5 and 7 every morning, and online 24 hours a day at www.swradioafrica.com.
For Zimbabweans looking for an independent source of news and information, SW Radio Africa is required listening.
Hello and welcome to Newsreel. My name is Terai Karimakwenda.
And my name is Violet Gonda. Some of our top stories.
South African observers and MDC meet to resolve differences.
Commonwealth rules out talks with Zimbabwe.
NGO officials under government surveillance.
And ZANU-PF intimidating MDC activist in KwaZana. These stories and more in the bulletin ahead.
The 7-person staff of SW Radio, the SW stands for Shortwave, broadcasts news 3 hours each evening and for 2 hours each morning to their homeland. They do all their reporting by phone, calling Zimbabwe, interviewing people about events that might otherwise go unreported in the heavily censored, state-controlled press. SW Radio Africa was set up in December 2001 by broadcast journalist Jerry Jackson after her independent radio station in Zimbabwe's capital Harare was shut down at gunpoint by Robert Mugabe's security services. It was just one violent act of censorship by a regime called by Reporters Without Borders one of the most repressive countries on the African continent. SW Radio is funded by several NGOs who Jackson will not name, although she acknowledges that in the past there may have been a relationship with USAID. With parliamentary elections looming in Zimbabwe, extraordinary steps have been taken to prevent the voters from hearing SW Radio Africa.
That means you are not being jammed. As you know, our broadcast signal is being jammed by the authorities in the run-up to this election. In an attempt to get around this, we are broadcasting on additional frequencies. We really do apologize.
Hosts Terai Karimakwenda and Violet Gonder read out the list of signals in the hope that some of what they are reporting can be heard. Gonder acknowledges it is a hope that can be hard to keep alive.
Of course, you know how it is. It's really frustrating to actually talk to thin air because that's how it feels like. You know, we get emails from all over the country, you know, people saying that they're frustrated that they can't receive us, they don't know what's happening, and you just feel that you're just broadcasting to no one.
The jamming of the station's signal started earlier this month, according to SW Radio's founder and editor, Jerry Jackson.
The jamming actually started on, it was a Monday, 7th of March, and we thought at first that it might be atmospheric interference. You know, shortwave is greatly affected by atmospheric conditions. So we kind of looked at that for a day or two, and then on the third day we realized, no, this is pretty serious. This is jamming. It was confirmed by various radio hams in Harare. You could identify the buzzing noise, and there were two, three different kinds of jammers.
This is the first time the Mugabe regime has attempted to censor the station by jamming its signal. Jackson says she doesn't believe there was a particular story that led to the government's action.
Do you know, I don't even think the government focuses on a particular story. They just want to shut down the democratic space. They're just going to shut down the media.
SW Radio's founder thinks the jamming is due to some new international friends the Mugabe government has courted.
There's been a lot of publicity in the state-owned media over the past 12 months of how much Chinese and Iranian help they're getting. They are stated to be there to help the government in telecommunications and broadcasting. So possibly this is all supposition. They sort of said, hey, we could jam this quite nicely for you if you like, and someone picked up on the idea.
The Zimbabwean High Commission in London was contacted for comment about the jamming, but failed to return calls. Host Terari Karamakwenda expected SW Radio Africa to be off the air this month, but not because it was being jammed. He expected the Mugabe regime to have collapsed under international pressure 2 years ago, and he hoped a new government would allow a free press, making SW Radio's broadcast from London unnecessary. That didn't happen, Karamakwenda says, because of Mugabe's own media skills.
He's been very cunning. He has managed to buy a lot of time just by using the media a lot. I think he's conned the international community into really taking their time dealing with him.
According to Karamakwenda, the crisis in his country is a crisis of governance, but Mugabe has managed to keep the international community from taking strong action against his dictatorial regime by playing the race card skillfully.
And he's made, I think, Americans and the British quite paranoid about acting in ways that they might have acted in the past, just for fear of being accused of being, you know, here come those imperialists again, or, you know, here come the whites telling us what to do.
Newsreel, by Zimbabweans, for Zimbabweans. Stories and issues that you need to hear.
Karamakwenda adds, the parliamentary elections will not loosen Robert Mugabe's grip on the country. First, he points out, there are serious questions about the fairness of the vote. An estimated 20 to 25% of the population have left the country during the years of Mugabe's rule, during which time the economy has collapsed. These expatriates are not being allowed to cast absentee ballots. Most of these exiles are believed to support the opposition Movement for Democratic Change, the MDC party. There is also concern about getting an accurate vote count. The army, loyal to the regime, will count the ballots. And then, even if the MDC gains seats in the parliament, Mugabe's presidential powers allow him to override parliament's actions. When the elections are over, SW Radio Africa's Jerry Jackson says she and her team will continue to try and provide an independent source of news and information for her fellow Zimbabweans. In her view, that's not a radical agenda.
I don't believe that we broadcast anything that shouldn't be on radio anywhere in any normal country at any time. It's voter education. It's what's happening. It's normal radio.
8 and 9 p.m.
Simsakanganwe. Don't forget the morning thing.
Oh, my goodness.
Hey.
Don't forget. Yes. Thank you, Terai, for reminding us.
So there you have it. Get us on Plan A, Plan B, or Plan C. But if you do hear us, it's a beautiful thing.
That report from Here Now's Michael Goldfarb reporting from London. Still to come, the late Jimmy Smith was the king of the Hammond B3 organ. His last CD has just been released. It features the king and his heir apparent. You're listening to Here and Now. The FBI has acknowledged that it accidentally returned a CD containing classified information to a former military translator who was sent to jail for illegally taking the disc from the Guantanamo Naval Base. Here now is Fred Tice joins us, and Egyptian-American Ahmed Mahalba has since been released from jail. And Fred, you've been speaking with him.
Well, we spoke to him last week, and the first thing he said, Robin, was that he loved working at Guantanamo.
Well, the weather is beautiful. The people who work there are fantastic. It was a really good experience for me. It really was. I mean, with the exception of that, how it ended, I guess, but it was a good experience.
A naturalized U.S. citizen, Mahalba felt that he was doing important work for his adopted country. He spent from November 2002 to July 2003 at Guantanamo. He went to Egypt to visit his sick father and then came back to Guantanamo for a month. And then, one day...
You had taken these documents home at Guantanamo to work on them.
That's correct.
To translate them.
Quarters. When I say home...
Home, you mean your quarters.
I mean my housing unit in Guantanamo.
And then what happened? Did you forget? You just forgot that you had this with you. Or you didn't think about it after that?
You just... I really rather not...
He says he'd really rather not discuss what happened after that. Federal authorities say he copied classified information onto his personal computer and took that information out of Guantanamo. Mahalba was arrested at Logan Airport on September 29, 2003. He was returning from his native Egypt. Among 130 computer disks he had with him, customs agents found one hand-labeled backup number 3 for MO's profile. On the disk, the agents found one file containing 725 government documents marked secret or secret no foreign, meaning they couldn't be shared with any foreign government.
They were asking me if I have any classified document with me, and I said no. So that was the full statement. They asked me if I was aware of what the term secret mean, and I said no.
He was arrested and kept in custody. In January, he pleaded guilty to unauthorized possession of documents relating to the national defense and lying to federal agents. This month, he was released after completing a 20-month sentence.
I lost my dignity, my friends, my sense of security and belief.
When he says he lost his friends, Mahalba says he means both his friends among the U.S. personnel in Guantanamo and his old Egyptian-American friends here in Massachusetts. He says his immigrant friends don't want to have anything to do with him, in part because they're scared.
It's a very intimidating scene when you find, you know, 4, 5, 6 FBI agents going knocking on your door.
Mahalba says his Egyptian-American friends have always looked at themselves as second-class citizens, as immigrants.
And I didn't believe in that. I really didn't. I really believed once you become an American, you are an American, and that's that. And I'm afraid that's not the case. I mean, I believe what they believe right now, which is once an immigrant, always an immigrant. Sort of a second-class citizen. Me being a U.S. citizen didn't absolutely mean anything in court. I thought it should make a lot of difference. It didn't. Except that I'm still here, I guess. It means a lot to me being an American citizen. And I truly believed in the values and the mottos and the advertising, you know, we do as citizens, as Americans. And when it comes to really to reality, it doesn't really mean anything, because just the fact because your name is Ahmed or Mohammed or Mahmoud or Hussein, you're an automatic suspect. I don't know of what exactly, but you know you are, which is a shame.
Ahmed Mahalba speaking with Fred Tice, who joins us now. Fred, after all this, how did that disk of classified information get back to Mahalba?
Last week, Mahalba went back to the FBI to pick up his personal effects, and they handed him back all the compact discs they had confiscated at Logan Airport. And when he got home, he realized that, much to his horror, that among the discs was the one disc that he had spent all that time in prison for. He immediately called the FBI, and they sent an agent over to pick it up.
Well, and we know the FBI made this public after you asked them about it. What did they say?
At first they said they wouldn't comment on it, and then the next day I guess they changed their minds and they announced that, yes, they had inadvertently given the disc to Mr. Mahalba and recovered it.
Just a mistake.
Just a mistake.
And how does Mr. Mahalba feel about all this?
He's just very nervous about everything right now. Understandably so. He's on parole. He doesn't want to get on the wrong side of the authorities.
Here now is Fred Tice. Fred, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
Stay with us. There's more. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now with this news update. Terry Schiavo has now been without nutrition or hydration for 10 days. Her parents, according to a spokesperson, are still hoping that Florida Governor Jeb Bush will intervene in the case. Today, though, Governor Bush said he didn't see any way for his office to get involved and that he must respect a series of federal court rulings against reinserting Schiavo's feeding tube. Schiavo's family is also battling about what should happen after she dies. Her husband says he wants her body cremated, and he wants her remains to be buried in the family plot in Pennsylvania. Her parents, though, do not want her cremated, and they want her body buried in Florida. A priest who is close to Schiavo's parents says the family will not press this issue in court. Monsignor Thaddeus Malinowski said, "We're all finished with the court system. That's the end." The jazz world is still mourning the death of Jimmy Smith, the master of the Hammond B3 organ, who died last month in his late 70s. But now fans are celebrating the posthumous release of his last CD, Legacy. The tracks were recorded last summer with fellow jazz organist and Smith disciple, Joey DeFrancesco. This track from the new disc is called Midnight Special. Joining us in the studio for more on the new CD, Legacy, Joey DeFrancesco with Jimmy Smith is here now. It's jazz aficionado James Isaacs. James, welcome.
Greetings, Robin.
And this is wonderful. And we should say this is the second collaborative recording between these two musicians. The first was the CD called Incredible. That was released in 2000. And then they were at it again last August, the result, this CD. What did Jimmy Smith mean to Joey DeFrancesco?
The world. Joey DeFrancesco was 6 or 7 years old when his father, Papa John DeFrancesco is how he is known, and he is also an organist. And Papa John took little Joey to see Jimmy Smith, and the rest is ongoing history because he was knocked out. Joey D basically taught himself, and it's not an easy instrument to learn, the Hammond B3 or any other organ.
Yeah, you got to play all those stops and everything.
Yes, well, indeed.
Tell us about the new CD.
Well, on this new album for the Concord Jazz label, there are a number of tracks that Jimmy Smith originally recorded for Blue Note during his heyday. Smith recorded for that great jazz label between 1956 and 1963, if memory serves. Tracks like the one we heard to start off today, Midnight Special, and there's Back at the Chicken Shack, and I've Got My Mojo Working, which was recorded for Verve, not Blue Note. Jimmy Smith went on to record for Verve in 1963 and stayed with that label for almost a decade.
A little bit more about Jimmy Smith, because we feel we've heard the Hammond B3. I'm thinking of Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, and it just started showing up everywhere. He really was the king. And why?
Well, I'll tell you, Jimmy Smith basically split the atom when it came to jazz organ. Certainly there were jazz organists before Jimmy Smith, but nobody, and I mean nobody, played with the fire, the speed, the accuracy, the unending inventiveness, and the overall incredible virtuosity. When you heard Jimmy Smith at the peak of his powers, it was like walking into the middle of a cyclone. You were just blown away. You know, he was a fantastic performer. His work was informed by Charlie Parker's. You know, it was translating the bebop idiom to the organ. That hadn't been done before.
Well, let's listen to some earlier recordings of Jimmy Smith's. What would you like us to hear?
Well, this track that we're about to hear was recorded for Blue Note in 1956, written by Dizzy Gillespie. It's called The Champ. And as I said, you're about to walk into a cyclone. Thank you.
The Champ from the Blue Note CD, the best of Jimmy Smith. And James Isaacs, Jimmy Smith was a true musical pioneer. You've compared him to other pioneers.
Yeah, I think of two people in mind, one a musician and one an entertainment personality. Both of these people left us within the past year. When I think of Jimmy Smith in terms of a musical personality, I think of Ray Charles, because they both broke the template in their respective idioms, jazz and soul. In Jimmy Smith's case, it was soul jazz that he helped pioneer, he and Horace Silver and Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers back in the 50s. So there's the Ray Charles connection, at least in my mind, and I don't think it's a stretch. But maybe this other connection is a bit of a stretch, Jimmy Smith and Johnny Carson.
Mm-hmm.
By that I mean that like Johnny Carson, Jimmy Smith had a number of subsequent competitors or disciples, whatever, but people like Brother Jack McDuff and Johnny Hammond Smith, Jimmy McGriff, and on and on and on. And Johnny Carson spawned Joey Bishop and Merv Griffin and Joan Rivers. They all tried their hand at the late-night television format, but no, ixnay, didn't work. The original's still the greatest.
Right.
And the heavyweight champion of all time of the Hammond B3, James Oscar Smith.
Well, let's hear some more of him then. Slaughter on 10th Avenue. This is from the CD Compact Jazz. We're going to get back to the newer CD, the newer release in a moment, but let's listen to a little of Slaughter. And what are we listening for?
We're listening, first of all, to the way that Oliver Nelson arranged for Jimmy Smith. They worked quite well together on a number of Verve albums. And you'll hear the way that the orchestra carries the melody, and Jimmy Smith plays very exciting counterlines on Slaughter on 10th Avenue from 1964.
Jimmy Smith playing Slaughter on 10th Avenue from the CD Compact Jazz from the 60s. But let's hear another track, James Isaacs, from his new posthumous release, Legacy, Joey DeFrancesco with Jimmy Smith. And with Jimmy Smith's passing a month ago, the torch has been passed to Joey DeFrancesco. Can he carry it?
Oh, he's been carrying it for a while. Joey DeFrancesco is a brilliant instrumentalist. He's just about to be 34 years old. And in some ways, he has surpassed his master. Joey DeFrancesco is certainly more au courant harmonically because, you know, he was raised on the music of John Coltrane during the 1980s, let's say, whereas Jimmy Smith came up during the 40s and 50s when Charlie Parker's radical bebop innovations held sway. Now, on the track we're going to hear, it's the most interactive number on this album. It's the blues, and they're knocking heads and jamming, and this is what it's all about. Blues for Bobby C., Joey D., Jimmy Smith.
Here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs. James, thank you as always.
My pleasure, Robin.
And for more information on the new CD, Joey DeFrancesco with Jimmy Smith, Legacy, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.